My next guest, another writer, but one occupying a very different world, Margot Jefferson's memoir, Negroland, opens a window on a world that few of us know about, the world of the black elite in the US in the 1940s and beyond. Margot was born in post-war Chicago to parents who were stylish and smart, gifted and black. Dad a doctor, mother a socialite. Margot and her sister grew up with a good education. They had tennis and ballet lessons. In other words, everything that comes with nice middle-class American upbringing. But they also grew up knowing that the wider world was rife with overt and covert racial prejudice. Their status could shield them from some humiliations and bring them a slew of others. They found themselves caught between the white and black worlds. In the words of the author, they were a third race. Jefferson grew up to become a cultural critic, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, and she's now a professor at Columbia University's School of Arts Writing. And she spoke to us from her home in New York City, and we began by asking her about the title of her memoir. The title itself is provocative, Negroland, because of all because of the whirls and eddies around the world Negro.
Yes. Well, I meant it to signify actually certain historical facts. Black people, Negroes, colored people, just this proliferation of names is a sign of our uncertain status and our struggle in the United States. Now, Negro is actually the word that we preferred, capitalized, to use for ourselves and to be used for us from about the beginning of the 20th century, you know, late 1890s, 1900s, through to the mid-60s, when, because of the rise of black power, black supplanted Negro, and subsequently African-American rather supplanted black. But I'm really writing about this post-World War II generation and the generations that preceded it, people born in the late 19th, early 20th century, when Negro was our preferred word. So I want it to signify a certain historical period.
Negro and land, of course, can be in Harlem or, in your case, in Chicago. It's not so much a physical place as a concept of a wider nation.
You are so right. It's a concept. It's a series of mythologies and beliefs and romances, even. Yes, that's absolutely right. Negroland was New York. Negroland was Washington, D.C. Negroland was Chicago. Negroland was Atlanta.
It's interesting that we've used the word privilege a few times already, and you make a very sharp distinction between privilege and entitlement.
I do. I think of entitlement in its classic sense as something that basically white people of many classes in America, but also around the world, take for granted. Entitlement is a sense of your, not just equality, your superiority bestowed at birth. I am entitled to certain rights and privileges, you know, because my blood does this. My blood gives this to me. Privilege can be taken away. Privilege can be bestowed by a new series of laws or rights, whether it's after the Civil War, when blacks had the privilege of being called free citizens. So there's a great difference. Privilege is much more perilous.
You described the privileged people in your class, and I found this a very powerful notion, a third race.
Well, I want to put some ironic markers around that. In the early parts of the 20th century, this group of, let's call them the haute bourgeoisie, of privileged blacks, we tended to think of ourselves as poised between all groups of Caucasians, of white people, and the larger masses of less privileged blacks. in some cases, this was because we were very aware of our mixed blood. Most black people, in fact, you know, are a mixture of African, European, and, you know, various others, perhaps Native American, whatever. But we tended to think of ourselves as situated between most black people, less privileged than we were, and all white people.
It's interesting and how much what
you're... When we were arrogant about ourselves, we felt that we possessed, you know, a certain wisdom and sophistication that no other group possessed. That was when we were being arrogant about ourselves.
Much of what you say will resonate with Indigenous Australians, except for the privilege.
I would think, yes.
Indigenous Australians are rarely privileged in the sense of your third class, but they're painfully well aware of the calibrations of class and caste and, yes, skin colour. We'll talk about that a little later. But your dad, your father was a paediatrician, head of a black hospital, your mother a former social worker, and you describe a life which, to a large extent, mirrored that of well-off white Americans. Ballet lessons, nice dresses, lots of emphasis on being nice. In fact, the word nice seems to be a very powerful one.
Nice, a good girl, well-behaved, you know, comportment, those sorts of words. And I want to emphasize that this was certainly true of how every minority group, particularly minority groups of color, ought to behave. I have found that East Asian, South Asian, Latino and Latina people from, you know, this same bourgeoisie experienced the same thing. We were expected in some way to work, to operate against, to counter every stereotype about our people and to prove constantly by our perfect behavior, good manners, perfect standardized speech, you know, excelling, of course, in school and all of that, to prove in all of those ways that we were absolutely equal. And in some cases, to have to be superior to show indeed that we were equal.
You can misbehave on this program, incidentally, Margot. You don't need to be nice at all.
Now, let me also emphasize how much this had to do with gender. Boys had to behave, but oh my God, girls of every race, but particularly black and minority girls in the 50s and 60s, we had to be utterly perfect, virtuous, good.
It was a very fine line to walk because while you were told not to act in a way that was seen as too black, you couldn't act in a way that was seen as too white.
Well, let me make a little distinction here. You could, in a certain way, in terms of your perfect diction and manners, you could never be too white, but you couldn't be arrogant. You couldn't appear to be claiming, you know, with too high-handed a way, certain privileges that might make powerful white people think that you were unduly arrogant, because then you would be punished.
The pressure that you were under as a child was considerable. I wonder whether it lasted into your later career when you're working for Newsweek and the New York Times. Were you still on your best behavior? Did you still feel that same sort of pressure?
Oh, I think we all did. I think all black people integrating these professions in the 60s and 70s felt that, and all women integrating these professions did. You know, the fact is, I'm a journalist. Most black journalists moved from black newspapers to white newspapers and news magazines not before the late 60s. And you know why? Because the various riots were starting in different American cities, and white newspapers needed black journalists who could go into these neighborhoods where a white person would be at risk or terrified, even if he or she wasn't at risk. So it was all very new. When I got to Newsweek in 1973, the women there, all of whom, including ones with PhDs, were working as researchers, had just made a settlement with Newsweek because they had threatened a suit if women were not promoted. So I was genuinely benefiting. Finally, American society, in this case journalism, being willing to promote blacks and women to equal status. So all of us had to, you know, we were holding up our race and our sex, absolutely.
Let's go back a few chapters, and I want you to tell us about what happened when Dr. and Mrs. Jefferson tried to check into an Atlantic City hotel. It's one of the more compelling anecdotes.
Oh, yes. I believe it was around 1956. And we were simply taking my family, Dr. and Mrs. Jefferson and their two daughters, Denise and Margot, were taking one of those summer vacations that Americans loved to take. The highway system was new, and we'd all get in our cars and drive cross country. And we had had a fine old time in Canada and Boston and New York, you know, staying at nice hotels and being treated well. And the last part of the trip was Atlantic City. We were just going to hang out on the beach. And when we tried to check in, the clerk, Atlantic City is in New Jersey, the clerk first claimed that he didn't have a reservation. And he said, Mr. and Mrs. Jefferson, looking very puzzled and unhappy and discontented. And my father said, no, Dr. and Mrs. Jefferson. And the clerk moved his finger up and down the list of incoming hotel registrants with excruciating slowness. And finally, he said, okay, Doc. Being a little overly familiar. Oh, Doc, I think we found you. We had to give you a different room. Meaning, when we were taken there, a very small room looking over a parking lot. You know, clearly a very shabby room. We had made these reservations, my mother and father had, weeks before, and there had been no problem. So my parents realized what was going on and decided that we would leave the next day. My sister and I wanted to eat, of course, in the hotel dining room. My parents decided we would not because they were quite sure, I'm sure correctly, that we would be treated badly there. The rooms were small and cramped. The bathtub had cracks and dirty stains in it. So we left the next day feeling humiliated. My parents felt deeply humiliated. My sister and I were somewhat puzzled. My mother tried to explain it to us. My father was, he'd kind of gone into a distant, angry state. So we weren't talking that much to him at that point. He wasn't, he was not really communicating. We left the hotel, got back in our car, and drove back to Chicago. And my parents, lamenting all the time that they had not taken that extra effort and checked with black friends who lived in the east near New Jersey, who could have possibly told them that this hotel would not be welcoming. In those days, there was even something, a black book, something called the Black Book, that told black families where they could, in fact, stay safely if they traveled across the country. And we had not consulted that.
Margot, I suddenly remember an extraordinary story in New York, in Manhattan, when Mahalia Jackson is refused admission by the Waldorf Astoria. And Paul Robeson, who at the time was a megastar playing Othello on Broadway, sat in the foyer. Just sat there implacably day after day until they finally let Mahalia in. It wasn't just Atlantic City.
No, it was most cities in the United States, absolutely. We had been fortunate in New York and in Boston and, in fact, in Canada, but that's a separate issue. So, no, it was depending on the year and the hotel. It could and did happen all over the country. There wasn't a black family in those decades of the early 20th century, meaning really 1900, through the 50s, well into the 60s. There wasn't a black family that didn't have some version of this story. when my father's brother, who was a judge in Los Angeles, and his wife and daughter drove from Los Angeles to visit us in Chicago, they almost had to drive straight through because every motel they stopped at would not take them.
This is Ellen Earl on RN Summer on air and via your ABC radio app. And my guest is Margot Jefferson, the author of Negroland, published by Penguin Random House. Margot, there are so many aspects to the book. One of the most fascinating is the potted history of what you term coloured society, starting with people who broke free of slavery by a variety of means to acquire some wealth and social position. Why has this history been so inadequately documented?
Well, that's an interesting question. I would say it's been documented, if we're speaking of books, you know, records, archives, but it has been very inadequately disseminated, discussed. And why is that? You know, racism, and I think, you know, this will be something that your Indigenous Australians and your white Australians will recognize. Racism depends on blocking out huge chunks of history that would counter it. It insists upon blindness and really erasure. So it is your job, if you are a society that is determined to maintain, you know, the hierarchies of that depend on racial prejudice, it's your job to ignore the historical evidence that would counter that.
As you write,
that historical evidence can range from accomplishments to uprisings.
For people of your generation in the post-war period, that rise upwards was accompanied by violence of many kinds. You described the fights to keep black families out of better suburbs, the laws designed to remove power, the lynchings, of course. And you write that for black women, there was always an undercurrent, or sometimes much more than an undercurrent, of sexual violence to contend with.
Yes. In my world, in my Negro land, this protected, as much as it could be protected, black bourgeoisie, black haute bourgeoisie, we were shielded practically, but we knew the history, which of course had started centuries before in slave time, that black women were liable to, slave or free, rape, forced sexual encounters, and to the reputation that arose to, again, excuse the men who were, in fact, abusing these women, the reputation that was imposed upon black women was one that said, oh, you know, you wanted this all the time. You were loose, you were slutty, you weren't interested in, you know, being married or having families. You were, you know, this was what you earned. This was what you wanted. So we were always countering these accusations, this slander, as it was passed down to me. And of course, you know, the history of women's rights and of the, you know, ideologies of womanhood enters here because, of course, what we were trying to live up to most of the time was this, you know, very narrow, insistent definition of women as they have to be pure, they have to be decorous, they have to want to do nothing really but marry and raise children and be spiritually even more pure than men. So we were trying to live up to versions and visions of what femininity is that, you know, we now know are pathetically constricted and oppressive.
One of the other things you write about is the fair-skinned black who could pass for white. Tell us about your uncle Lucius, who would occasionally appear at your house, and he'd chosen to pass as white for professional reasons and was accepted thus.
Well, my uncle Lucius was typical of many very light-skinned black people. Again, since as long as there have been black people in the United States and there have been racial, there's been what we call miscegenation. There have been people light-skinned enough with, you know, what we think of as Anglo-Saxon features, who have always crossed the racial lines, as we called them, and passed for white. My uncle Lucius, my great uncle Lucius, he was the brother of my paternal grandmother. Basically, at a certain point in his life, I'm not sure when, crossed over and worked as a traveling salesman most of his life. I knew nothing about him until he retired and came back into the world of his then Negro relatives. It was very challenging for him because he had only seen them, you know, very occasionally over the years. He was ill at ease. He accused all his Negro relatives of neglecting him at a certain point, which I think, you know, psychologists and psychiatrists would call a kind of, you know, projection, who had been neglecting whom. And it turned out, I found out years later, because my parents and Uncle Lucius just sort of stopped seeing each other, that they had been fine about his passing for white, because that was just something that generations of Black people understood. If you had to do it for, you know, to advance your career, it was really understood, and it was, those secrets were not violated. But they condescended to him somewhat. They looked down on him a little because all he managed to do was be a traveling salesman. And as they saw it, and I think there was a little bit of a revenge motive here, they were doctors, lawyers, judges, etc. So you were supposed to, if you were going to pass for white, you were supposed to be able to excel in some way and succeed in some way that you couldn't if you were Black. So why couldn't he do better than being a traveling salesman? Which I think in some way was, you know, a little bit their revenge on Uncle Lucius.
Not long before he died, I talked to Arthur Miller, who was a lifelong hero. And, of course, we discussed Death of a Salesman. I suddenly can imagine a new production of Death of a Salesman in which Willie Loman is like your great uncle. It would add another dimension to the story.
That's very interesting, and that's very astute. And at the very end, he loses his territory. Absolutely right. I like that a lot.
Now, I have to ask you this. Your previous book was about Michael Jackson, whose transformation over the years seemed born out of the kinds of pressure we're talking about, particularly to look white. Is that how you saw the Jackson tragedy?
I saw it in a slightly more complicated way. Michael Jackson had a very troubled family life and a very cruel father. And as I researched his story, and I'm not the only person who said this, it became very clear to me that one deep obsession of his was not to resemble his father in any way. And he really began pretty early on, long before his skin started lightening, to remake his face so that he did not have his father's nose, features, anything. And the other siblings started to do this too. It has never been fully verified as to whether Michael Jackson had vitiligo, that skin disease that if you have pale skin makes you brown, dark in patches, and if you have dark skin makes you white in patches. He said that he had it. Some people have said he had. Others have said he hadn't. If he had vitiligo, I do understand why he would be lightening his skin to match the light patches. He clearly also, in terms of his skin color, gender questions and transformations, was very, let us say, conflicted and also constantly, you know, mutating himself. But I see it as involved with race, with gender, but also with deep family matters.
I'm rereading a letter your mother wrote to a girlfriend in 1944, and she's describing her life as an army wife. Your father's working as a doctor at the All Black Army Hospital. And your mother ends the letter by saying, "I'm so happy. Sometimes I almost forget I'm a Negro." What did you think when you read that sentence?
I was absolutely overwhelmed and incredibly moved and almost heartbroken when I first read that sentence, because what she was saying, the context was she was writing a friend of hers about a young woman they both knew who was going to, just about to get married. And my mother was saying, you know, "I wish her all the happiness that I have, because it's more than I could possibly have imagined. Sometimes I almost forget I'm a Negro, and that's something, huh?" Which was basically, my mother was saying, you know, "I am living in this world that white people take for granted. You are unhappy. Sometimes you are happy, sometimes, but you are not constantly aware, shouldering the responsibility of and the burden of what America's definitions of and impositions of race will make of you and demand of you."
Margot, we've talked about your response to your mother's words. I'm wondering about her response to yours. Now, she dies before the book's published, but she did see some parts, some early drafts. How did she feel about them?
Well, the parts that she saw, which were in many ways very flattering to her, she was enormously charming and intelligent, and she saw parts in which I had written about her influence on my sense of fashion and the power of clothes and style, not just good manners, but style, and how that gave you a sense of power and equality and pleasure. And the passages, the portions of the book that she saw, she thoroughly enjoyed. She was proud of me. I think, you know, she was a private person, and the world, her generation, was very protective of their world and, you know, of all its rules and rituals. And so I think she would have struggled a bit with my being so forthright about, you know, some of our unhappiness and some of our conflicts and some of our snobberies, etc. But she was proud.
How did your father relate to you? Because I understand from another interview you did that he opened up more than once when he was in his 80s.
He, in his later years, my father was a very kind and lovely man, but when I was young, he was really at the hospital and at his office a great deal of the time. He and my mother were very careful about what racial stories they told us. In his later years, certain traumas, really, of his earlier life, racial traumas, some of his experiences at University of Southern California, with white doctors from the South, at the University of Chicago, where he'd gotten a fellowship. These would come flooding out sometimes with a kind of grief that I had not seen, that he had very much protected me from when I was young and when my sister was young. And it was heartrending, actually.
So you and your entire family had to censor your emotions as well as your behavior.
I would say we, to some extent, we censored. To some extent, we modulated. We were very aware that in some way, even in our most intimate moments, we were under the spyglass, under the magnifying glass of American society. We also had many lovely times together and, you know, many intimate and charming moments. But we knew this, yeah.
Has the situation for Black Americans, for members of, if you like, of the third race, has that improved considerably or not?
Well, I hope, you know, I don't want to think only of the members of the third race. The real question, as W.E.B. Du Bois put it, was, you know, how are we helping and, I don't know, helping advance the entire race? things, certain things for certain, you know, people, black people, have improved, but the larger masses are still struggling. And we are locked, not only black people, but, you know, many disenfranchised groups. We, you know, Arabs, Latinos, we are locked in a big struggle right now.
Margot?
Not to be pushed backwards.
Margot, wonderful to talk to you. Margot Jefferson, we talked about her surname off-air, and there, yes, may well be a link going back to the constitutional era. Margot is a journalist, professor of art writing at Columbia University, and author of Negroland.